evening. I'm delighted to be here at Avail and have the opportunity to read for you. I'd like to thank Paul for the kind invitation and for brief, I know the introduction, and the Long Valley for providing this great venue, and most of all for you for showing up tonight, and I hope you enjoy it. My collection is called Fingerprints on Canvas, and there's no poem without title, but the title of the book comes from this next poem, which is called Godchild, Stillbirth, and it's from Louis Joseph Collins. I am your godmother, and yet when you were born, I didn't know how to hold you or touch you. I couldn't see past those plastic flowers they wrapped your tiny peeling fingers round, or the image of you being transported from the labour ward in the blanket-covered Moses basket, or the room with the holy pictures and the low rock lamp where you waited for our introduction. I was blinded by your frowning forehead, your skin dark from waiting to be born. Hold him, hold him, pick him up and hold him. I took pictures, closed my eyes through the lens, looked at the small table lamp, the crochet blanket, the floor. I watched your Nana, though, my sister, take away the plastic flowers, scoop you gently into her arms, and talk to you, talk to you. My darling little boy, I'm your Nana, and I've waited a long time to meet you. It's okay, my darling, you're safe now, nothing can harm you. And without warning, you were there in my arms, surprised by the weight of you, the feel of you. I held you to my breast, and I met you. I met you. No words can explain that meeting, but I met you. I met you. Now, when I am quiet, alone, painting, you pull the kitchen chair to the table, kneel up to get a better view. Your curls, wiry and unruly, bounce with your rhythm as your small fingertips dip in the paint, often leaving their mark at the edge of my canvas. This poem is called Blue Sirocco, Land for Rocking. Sirocco sand clouds eat the sky, smother the sun, leave the lava beneath my feet, cold like your hands pressed to the side of my face, your lips moving slowly round the words, round this body, lost in the Atlantic, erupting from restless plates. Deep, deep beneath your heartbeat touches mine, the taste of salt, lust mingled with amber solaire, goosebumps rising like mountains from a smooth horizon, one slow bead of sweat roller coats over goose hills, between breaths, a tantalizing finger leading the storm onwards. My Nana, from my mother's mother, had a stroke when she was about 38, I think, and later in life became bedridden because of it. But she was a very big part of our life. And this is a poem about her. It's called My Nana, the Woman Who Bought Bicycles. My Nana, she gave us a 10p from her pension each week. We queued like ants waiting to be fed, amazed by the silver coin distributed from bed. My Nana, one day she gave me a 50p. I was awestruck, delirious with joy. Did she realize her mistake, took it back and made me cry. My Nana, when you were 8 years big, she gave you a bicycle all your own. No matter where you went or what you did, that bicycle was yours alone. My Nana, I waited like a real good kid for my 8th birthday to arrive. Then Nana pulled a fast one, off she went and died. Sometimes my poems tend to be about two things that come together in the poem. This one is about having something to say and not being in a position where you can say it. It's called Destiny. A blackbird flies home, his beak full of chips, as if he'd been to the takeaway, flying home to feed his family. I too feel like my mouth is full, threatening to spill over, falling from the sky on people's heads, pouring from my lips, streams, not sentences or logic, just angry, frustrated feathers, crowd my mouth, dry tickle my throat, coughing out small black filaments, blocking out the light, like millions of tiny blackbirds fluttering round my head, being twigs for nest building, horse hair for binding, speckled eggs bubble forth until I remember my role, catching a shadow against sky. I follow the blackbird home to see his family. This poem was commended for the We Are Poetry competition. It was something a woman told me once, that it wasn't acceptable 70 years ago for a woman to admire her husband. This was called The Sergeant's Wife. She had angled the mirror, taking care not to reflect her lust over cold October nights he was habit forming, always undressing by the corner chair, draping his braces and trousers over the arm to prevent his creases, allowed her marvel at his reflected body, closing her eyes at his glance, then slowly opening, watching his chest muscles tighten as he bent to remove his underwear. She feels the heat crawl beneath the patchwork quilt, brushing against her calves, caressing her inner thighs, spreading up her body. The sharp intake of the cold rise of the colours before the heat of it settled inches from her back. She'd wait his turn, praying his arms would gather up her nightdress, pull her to him, cold and empty those nights he faced the wall, leaving only the rhythm of his breathing and the strangely soothing feel of hair on the back of her legs. You know those mornings when you get up and you and your partner are on the same page? You both want to do the same thing, you want to eat at the same time, you want to go to the same place as well. This is about when the absolute opposite to this happens. It's called today. Today, I am the hills, you are the valleys. I am the trees, you are the grass. I am the stubborn mountain sheep, you are the barbed wire catching on my wool, picking at my flesh, fencing me in. I negotiate your barriers, crawl beneath your lines, skirt the road, barely shifting for the angry traffic, weaving between the long grass, swaying to the sound of this, my mountain, my home. Sure-footed on more grass and milkwork, I scale the precipice, glue my feet to the hillside, bleat and bleat, but you don't hear me, can't understand my cries, my desperate burst for freedom. All you know is your empty field, and my gait distinctive in red, migrating towards the aloof fern, and the sky waiting on the horizon. This poem is called No Longer Sexy. I've stopped writing sexy poems. My inspiration has turned to war, motherhood, wife. I've forgotten to undress a staple of myself. Now I write sensible knicker poems, big and long and covering everything. There is no fringe of lace, no hint of furtive longing, no whisper of lust between the lines. I look at fit first and think, that should be me. But I've lost the art of seduction. I'm naked now, bearing all my imperfections. Rippling white pillows of skin, hairy legs and armpits and chins. A stretch marked zebra, canting through the Serengeti, flashing my rump a disinterested herbivore, knowing there is no chase in them, yet hoping there is something in me I can't find in myself. I had a conversation with a friend of mine recently, and I asked me how it came up, but it was about death. And she informed me quite categorically that when she died, she wanted the best coffin money could buy. I have to say, I thought that was the strangest thing I had ever heard anybody say. This poem is called When I Die. When I die, bury me in cardboard. The box from Holly's high chair should be fine. Stencil some handles on the side, and colour with those little markers we bought way back in May. Wrap me in an old knobby sheet, we have many, and let me lie as I did in sleep, reposed on the kitchen table, amongst the things I love. And when they shake your hand, I'm sorry, whispers Hugh. Ask them why, and laugh loudly at their answers, knowing I'd be laughing too. Please hang Lizzie on the stereo, so the room vibrates with sound, and when they're ready to depart, Eurythmics right by your side. Carry me to the garden, where every morning sunshine warms the worms, and plant me edged by that brick border, the cherub birdbath at my crown. So I can face the kitchen window, no wreaths or plastic flowers please. In time, replant the hanging rose and let its voracious roots impale me. Offer no supplements to the mourners, we're short enough of puffs. And when they've left, the grass recoiling from their print, let you and Holly come, pull up the garden bench, hold her on your knee, and tell her how proud I was to be her mammy. And when she's safely snug in bed, the bottles washed and sterilized, the boil wash nearly done, sit with me while you smoke your evening break, knowing I'm inhaling every breath. And when your chores are ended, each muscle aching clean, look out the kitchen window and say goodnight to me. I'm not a great fan of weddings, whether it changes or being one of the main people. I'm always amazed by the amount of effort people will go to at a wedding to get the perfect outfit or have the perfect day. This is called the wedding hat. The mother of the bride stands before the plate glass window, the small pillbox hat, a light shade of lilac with its matching net and flowers, the final item in a list that is extended 18 months. Today she is wearing the mother of the bride's shoes to break them in, to ease that excruciating pinch in the right foot. She can't understand why she doesn't get this over with. Purchase the hat, it is ideal. Then she sees a reflection next to her own, roughly the same height, but somewhat smaller head. And even though they've met only twice, she recognizes immediately the mother of the groom. Suddenly jolted into life and without a sideways glance, the mother of the bride pushes the store door wide and hobbles to the hat counter to claim her prize. The fitting is fraught with disagreement. There is only one size left and the shop assistant is determined it is too small. The mother of the bride is furious. After all, she is wearing shoes that threaten to amputate a toe. The hat is hers and she has no intention of giving that woman her hat as well as her daughter. 2 weeks later at St. Francis Church, the smell of orchids fills the air. The mother of the bride smiles sweetly at the mother of the groom, hatless. It is worth the discomfort of the lilac net that continually slips from her head, pulling her hair that has been superglued in place. She owns that feeling of superiority. At the church door, when the tears are dry and covered with a new layer of makeup, she sees the mother of the groom kiss her daughter on the cheek. Sorry, but the hat love can't wear the dancing, odd-shaped head, and her daughter the traitor. It's no problem, I hate hats myself. This is a poem for anybody who's ever written a poem, but more importantly, anyone who's ever had the courage to send it out. I realised when I picked it tonight that it's a little bit dated because it's about getting a response to your work sent out by post, and we don't really do that anymore, it's mostly by email. But I had this fantastic idea that I would get a special type of envelope so that I would always know that there was a response to the work that I had sent out. This is called Facing Mecca. The whole floor, beige and terracotta, lit by eastern sunshine, possessed me, my Mecca, where the shade falls, patterned by the ivy. I cannot return home without checking their vacancy or occupation. A little half-stop, expectant possibilities, but only the watermarked magnolia can send me on my knees. Please, please. The Sherlock Holmes of envelopes, I can deduce the contents, the number of returned poems with just a finger squeeze. A deluge of profanity for those who saw fit to return my life's blood is uttered here on these tiles. Or glorious jubilation when fingers in, the envelope is kissed, bowed down before, adored. The snap of the letterbox, a starter shot, catapults me from the arms of a lover, the depths of a mourning lion. I am a disciple. I carry the stigma of our teaching, the crucifying pain of waiting. This is called Red. He said my chi was unbalanced, suggested I wear a red linen shawl around my waist to keep my liver warm. Yoda of the herb world laughed at my expression, admitted it sounded odd, but red always means heat, he explained. So I wore it next to my kidneys, like the scarlet woman wrapped in reminders of lust. I wore it for my gallbladder, for all hope of redemption. Then he heated me with bamboo and poulan, spiced me with cinnamon, peppered me with peony. Seasoned so, he grilled me lightly for 3 years, turning every quarter until my mouth grew apples, my skin sprouted olives, peppers hung where my breasts had been. Then he wrapped me in vine leaves and buried me on the shore. Warmed by the earth, I waited centuries until I was born from my sandhole, wriggling out in a bush of warm sea water, naked but for the birthmark, a ring of red around my middle. You think you know somebody, but it's only when you spend a little bit of time, in an extended period of time maybe with them, that you know whether you're compatible or not. This is called thaw. After 3 days of living in one another's ear, I want to take my clothes off, climb naked into the fridge, curling to a fetal pose, close the door, a hushed click, marked by the trays and shelves, piled with decaying cheese, curdled milk, last night's Chinese, or was it last week? You will find me, a light dusting of frost like baby powder, my knees drawn to my breast, my fingers locked, crisp, fresh, rejuvenated. In explanation, a short note, pinned to the drink dispenser, leave to defrost overnight. This poem was shortlisted for the Fish International Poetry Prize and won second place in the Class Poetry Competition. It was an attempt to put the accepted norms of our relationship in today's context onto one say from 50 years ago. It's called If I Was Your Wife. If I was your wife, dinner wouldn't be ready or even thought of when you rounded the bend at 6. I'd be in the yard, barefoot, probably naked, painting nettles and dock leaves in bright garish blue. Your children unwashed, your houses you left it. Your hunger forgotten, wondering as you came to a stop, what had occupied your thoughts in saving work. You wouldn't have felt the need to wash in the red pan in the coal back kitchen, scrubbing to your elbows, futilely trying to erase the oil crease on your pan, pushing water onto your face, blowing out loudly, scrubbing down to your breastbone, leaving your neck red bottles with effort. You wouldn't have sat at the bottom of the oblong table, waiting for your dinner to be placed, or looked between the rows of your children at your wife, sitting at the opposite end, one word, chef, or she wouldn't have risen without pause and passed your seat to retrieve the brown sauce you demanded days the dinner wasn't up to much. If I was your wife, I would have answered, bollocks to your chef, and told you get off your arse and get it yourself. But we would never have reached the table. We would have eaten from the earth, raw mud-covered spuds and carrots, laughed as the nettles stung our mouth, made love of the tall grass, the children playing tag in the yard, knowing only the freedom of having nothing, but loving it, embracing it. We wouldn't have slept in separate beds with quilts and pillows for solace, but lay on the bare ground, comfortable in each other's arms. And when the tortured razor lines of life tore through our story, you would have held me, frail, embracing every flaw of my being, squeezing support, never letting go, if I was your wife. I have a healthy obsession with my ethics. I always wonder, you know, when you reach your ethics, you know, I ever wonder, it's like being in a different world. Mm-hmm. It's so cold up there. The air is so different. And this poem is called Just Listening. She had a man in her attic where the roof joists sloped to their lowest point. In at the corner, crouched, he talked to her, usually when she least expected it. He had an accent, Asian origin. He read fortune cookies, told her when she should sing, when the bees in her garden were idle, when watermelons ripened outside. She liked having him there. It combated the loneliness, the routine that kept her going but threatened to kill her. He was her sanity. She liked to take her clothes off, climb her skyway into the air that hinted at him, pull up the ladder, heave the springs closed, to lie on the bare chipboard floor and listen to him breathe. Calm, quiet breaths that sang of mountains rolling with grass, peopleless, where his fingers strummed each blade, filling the air with his harmony. This was a poem about the cruelty of adults and how they'll say something in front of a child that they should never say. It's called The Whore's Daughter. In a time when women stayed at home, saved their gift for the one worthy suitor, she lived with her mother's sin, bore her mother's stain through school, quiet, timid, frightened by so many headlights swinging through their yard, so many whispers of men, strange murmurs, grunts in dark alleyways, bright smudged lipstick, short skirts, crooked seams, haunted adolescence. She was just a child, fighting the cruelty of children, repeating words they didn't understand, the hurt a long blade that opened wounds for 20 years, until she finally bled to death, from the shame, the unforgettable image of the mother she lost. I used to live before there was a Chinese takeaway across the road, and I used to call it the Chinese chipper because it had the nicest chips ever. The lady who owned the Chinese takeaway liked to entertain her takeaway guests as best she could. She was a real character now, and it was very funny, and she would do her best to keep everybody entertained. This is called the Chinese chipper. Why you what? He takes a discreet step forward. I phoned in an order. This matches his suit. His discreet purchases increased menswear bags. He doesn't belong in a Chinese takeaway.
What do you order?
The duck.
No, I'm not the duck!
He nods. She moves to the kitchen, returning, she asks,
no, I'm not the duck!
Another nod.
You order the duck by phone.
Another yes.
I'm not in order for duck. They not in order for duck. No sign of the duck. You're ring in order yourself.
He is extremely still. He knows that everyone knows he's in the wrong Chinese takeaway. when somebody dies, we usually say, I'm sorry for your loss. To lose something is like that you can find it again. This is called to find you. If I lost you between Cork and Macroom, I'd go back, search for days and days, until one morning I'd see you standing at the road's edge, your ribs prominent with hunger, waiting, knowing I would come. I'd place you gently on the seat beside me, take you home, feed the flesh back on your bones and let you mother me, knowing I would never lose you there again. This is called Rain. On the wood of the bathroom floor, there's a profile of an eagle, his one eye visible, big and round, pitch pupil, with a pin of white. His feathers full, watching the branches sway, gravity pressure pumping, the smell of the clouds. I press my face to his, smell the dust between the floorboards, feel his spirit press my cheek, his tears wet as he takes the strain, pushing, pushing, rising up, away from the unending search for food, away from the syringe, the smell of sweat, the wetness between my legs, with awful moaning in my head, up, up to where the clouds sit far below, the blue swallows us, blinding, before I finally close my eyes and walk out the only door available, closing it quietly behind me. This is a poem in memory of Tom Mulqueen. It's called Coring Apples. I remember my father's weathered hands like parchment, the way the chemo grew out of his nails, the way his hair grew back white as frost and curling like my baby daughter. I remember he never got to meet her, never knew it was a girl, but that was right, he said, that he would go to make room. He would have been proud to know it would take two to replace him. I remember trying not to notice the hospice beds emptying around him, the tremble in his hands as he brought the beaker to his lips, the way his eyes wandered to the window and the tower beyond. I remember sitting by my father's bed, painstakingly peeling apples, a ribbon of skin firming on my lap, a sign, he said, of a steady hand, safe hands to leave things in. I remember wishing his palms were pressed with earth from planting winter saplings, or rhythmically folding, creasing, folding, while reciting from memory, verse after verse of Clifford of Kipling. I remember my father's weathered hands, fingers laced around the worn beads of his Medjugorje rosary, wax warm and motionless, the skin brown like apple cores and thin as tissue paper, and I remember thinking how they were, strong faith has. I was never very good at language, and I have to say that Irish was one thing that I always wanted to be able to learn, and I never did. And this is a poem called Language. This morning, I felt I should bless myself before breakfast. My customary cornflakes replaced by the full Irish, and used leading their lamps to ground. Last night, I met a woman who said she drinks in Irish, and I felt cheated. Deprived by the Englishman with a handlebar moustache crunching toast at the next table. Deprived of fathers in my sleep, of the erotic dreams I would have had off Gilda. Instead, I couldn't dream. My famine conscious mind refused to participate in the suffering of fantasy, leaving me exhausted, embittered against a generation who learned peace of dormant and disarmament. And I realized I am the old man at Molly Darty, watching the last 20 minutes of Ireland versus England, shouting about the British bastards who starved the country, leaving us to rot in potato blight and absentee landlords. I'm looking for the Powell Dove in the universe, the excuse for my laziness. I'm looking for the Dina Bukta, but all around me prosper, not pouring out the black stench of blight to find a sip of sustenance. Call me a Gairi, tell soon. I want to dream of Gaelga. I want to know who at my very core I am, and as my cholesterol sings, coursing through my body are strings of data, hard-coded in my cells, and I know at that level, I speak only one language. I come from a large family, there were 7 of us, and we never really went to many places, and I know now why we didn't. This is called the Sardines Day Out. How far more, the sardines asked on the edge of their universe from the back of the Rillard 5. Ages, yes, the driver said. Well, that's not an answer. And with no room to do anything except smell each other and no patience to speak of, they asked again, how far more? This time the driver gives no coherent answer, so they busy themselves jostling for position, each wanting to sit near a window, and everybody knows 7 into 2 does not go. So as predicted, one sardine ends up crying, frightened only by the promise of chips on arrival there. How far more? The driver refuses to answer, leading to speculation that it is much, much further. That's when the smallest sardine informs the car that she must pee. The driver asks, can't you hold it? Surprised, she answers, you can't hold pee. They stop then, but only the peer is allowed out. So all the sardines suddenly want to pee. Finally, they set off again, repacked and recramped there. How far more? Still no answer. What seems to them ages later, the middle sardine pukes all over the other sardines. There are screams and pushes and another stop, longer this time. Are we there yet, when they have reassembled? Still no answer. So after a brief discussion they ask, how far more? Are we there yet? No, the driver barks. Apoplectic Mammy Sardine says. They like that word, even though they have no idea what it means. So they practice it. Apoplectic. That isn't helping, Mommy Sardine says to shush now. So they are for a long, long, long time before I see. How far more? Are we there yet? These next two poems are about where I grew up, and these are actually both is set in the same place. The first one was in response to something I read in the shop about the fact that very few poems come in about war, and I said I'd write a poem about war, and it actually came out as something slightly different. It's called No Man's Land. Between them was No Man's Land, the purple landscape creased and wrinkled, vast as the universe. Lost in the absent echo, words lost in the absent echo claimed their prize of narrow lands on the edge of their respective abyss. In between, the fertile plain where she was conceived, worth fighting for night after night, flares burst on the headboard, illuminating the blood-red trenches, coils of razor wire strung out along marked pitted hills, ragged chunks of flesh and hair hung as reminders of unsuccessful forays into the minefield middle, that which neither could surrender, now a wasteland of ice and snow, leaving puckered backs exposed, aching limbs hanging on to crippling postures for fear of rolling in, of capitulating. This was called green. You know the way you can't control a dream, but sometimes when you're in the dream, you realize that something isn't quite right. I'm walking alone by my birth home. The sun flicks the tongue beneath a heavy leaf cover, giving a dappled effect to the ground. It must be summer because I'm wearing a t-shirt, a white one with cats painted on the front. As I get close to the piggery, I hear voices. Snatches float on, the details sifted through the trapping of the leaves. A warm breeze saunters from the well's gate. Self-consciously, I tug on the t-shirt. At the corner by the hay shed, I see you. I know you, but have no idea who you are. You're discussing the car you're sitting in, a lime green Ford Escort four-door. You become aware of me. I'm conscious of the t-shirt, uncomfortable with its length, because I'm naked from the waist down. I can't understand why I'm here without my knickers. I can't go back to face the main road. I can't continue on, not now that I know. So I stand there, watching you, wishing my t-shirt was a few inches longer, and wondering why I can't see the pebbles press the soles of my feet. Sometimes when you read somebody else's work, it brings out in you an image that you had completely forgotten about, but the image is so strong and so vivid for you, you think, how could I have forgotten that all those years? This is called Between the Lines. Another poet draws water in galvanized buckets up the narrow passage to Deneen. He doesn't have a piggery or wraps beside his cat, but my memory reads between his lines, changing the water to frothy milk, sloshing in the gallons burning heat. The fear of spilling the precious cargo weighed with the overwhelming fear of meeting one of the Jones, slowed by poison crossing the lane, their beaded eyes staring down the funnel of our escape, knowing the sting of the sally for every wave that pressed the lip and flows down the side, breadcrumbing our retreat. We stand immobile, moving only the gallons, hand to hand, pulling against the weight to relieve the wealth of red rising on our sweating palms. Our fears growing with the fading light, we settle on skirting, one either side, shooing and stamping. He watches us draw level, then ups his bulk on tiny wasted legs, my gallon slipping to my fingertips and gone, my feet gathering speed until we're home, crying with the loud trailer of his following and the knowing of what lies ahead. This one is for my daughter, Holly, called The Birds. The birds are feasting on our bird feeder, the one we filled with peanuts the day I bought the butterfly wellies to navigate the swamp of the back garden. We tried to ease your tongue around the word butterfly, annoyed when I didn't realise you wanted to press your cheek to mine, flutter your long lashes in the kiss your deadly torture. I wanted us to go out, air, blow away the web of self-doubt that had taken purchase in me, and we did make the squelching journey to retrieve the empty feeder, swaying pointedly in the breeze. You helped me prop its wire cage against the flower pot, coaxing nuts along its narrow neck, squealing with delight as the robins and finches dipped above our heads, approving of our industry. Satisfied we had retrieved every stray nut scurrying along the footpath, we squelched fast to hang up our bounty, letting go of your hand for that split second to hook the feeder in place. I turned to find you joyfully sitting, splashing your hands in the grass and laughing at the eager birds diving for cover in the nearby honeysuckle. This is the last one. Thank you very much for being such an attentive audience. This is a poem that I don't leave home without. It's one of those ones that's kind of, I don't know, it's just... It was written really as something very straightforward and simple, but it's had a life of its own, and it just seems to get itself published in things that I had nothing to do with. So it's for my grandmother, who came from Leffens, Riverine, and she was a bit of a character. It's called 92 and Driving. She was 92 and driving, couldn't see a bloody thing, but she was 92 and driving. The peripherals are meant, she'd answer when they'd ask about her sight. She was 92 and never wore glasses. She liked to squeak in the car. She thought it gave her a youthful look. She was 92 and didn't look 60. She was still glamorous, careful with herself. She loved to be noticed. People noticed her more in the car. She was 92 and driving. She would like to travel more. She felt it was the way to stay in touch. She touched lots of things. She was 92 and driving. Her philosophy, men like women with independence, long hair, who wear hats. She always wore a hat. She was 92 and still looking. When she got old, she'd stop, she said, because it might be dangerous. But after all, it was only a hat. She was 92 and driving. Thank you very much.